Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the top experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's pioneering research started the national movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at developments in the banking industry, economics, and money itself, and we'll update you on developments on the public banking frontier. Our program is underwritten by Payment Management Merchant Credit Card Services at paymentmgmt.com.
The more they talk about it, the more sense it makes. Now that makes them a leader in their community. It makes them an innovator. They're bringing something new, a solution to the table. And then now they take on that role of being a civic educator. Because to be a good leader, especially when you're edging out this idea of a public bank, you have to educate. But at the end of the day, best leaders will have a solution. And they say, you know what? We have a solution for you. And don't take my word for it. Just look at the great state of North Dakota.
And so we shall. Hi, this is Walt McCree, Chair of the Public Banking Institute, welcoming you once again to another edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Today we're going to hear from one of the most prominent experts on the history of the Bank of North Dakota, America's only publicly owned state bank, almost 100 years old, during which time it never failed to provide that state with remarkable financial flexibility and depth, which has made it the envy of Wall Street banks for efficiency and profitability. It's a history of people working together to protect themselves from the monopolies of economic and political power that were ripping away the assets, livelihoods, and health of those rugged entrepreneurs on the prairie, North Dakota farmers. These simple but resolute folks banded together to create one of America's great democratic financial institutions, the state-owned public bank, now a model for the rest of the country, indeed the entire world, as people continue to struggle together to reclaim control of their money from the private interests that have taken over around the globe. Later, we'll be hearing how those private interests have maneuvered the great city of Chicago into a financial hole that's forcing great strains on the entire region by facing seemingly endless budget deficits. But Chicago is not broke, says our guest Tom Tresser in his new crowdsourced book that lays out very clearly why Chicago is far from broke and gives us three ways to correct the problem, problems that apply to many other cities across America. Tom's opening statements to this show indicates how we the people are the true leaders of the change we need, with a proven solution available, the Public Bank of North Dakota. Later, Matt Stannard will be along with this week's Public Banking Report, a new look at what Wall Street costs America in two American cities, Detroit, Michigan, and Harrison, New Jersey, where you see the same private capital players at work undermining the financial stability and security of the citizens, a phenomenon you can witness at work around the world. Ellen and I have been reflecting on this reality, how global banking interests are taking down democratic governments all over the world through manipulating their regimes of debt, forcing the people to hand over their assets to pay the global financiers.
Right. So we can see that in Brazil, for example. Nomi Prince was just on Max Kaiser, and she was describing how it's about several things. The fact that the president, Dilma Rousseff, is now under impeachment proceedings.
And smeared as if she's the corrupt one, when in fact something else is going on.
Yeah, so her big corruption, the big thing she did wrong, was to borrow from the state-owned banks. There are three big state-owned banks that were set up by President Lula, who in 2001 basically rescued the country from bankruptcy, total collapse. So he was backing these big state-owned banks, which I wrote about in Public Bank Solution at length. In fact, all the BRICS that I wrote about in the Public Bank Solution are under attack for their public banking system, it looks like. So anyway, in Brazil, what she did wrong was to borrow from the state-owned banks sort of secretly, so it was considered cooking the books in order to maintain all those social programs that she's committed to do. In order to avoid austerity, but to meet her budget, she borrowed from the state-owned banks. But we do the same thing. I mean, we did quantitative easing where we borrow from our theoretically publicly owned bank, the Federal Reserve, but we just put a fancy name on it. We say, oh, well, that's quantitative easing, you know, so we're allowed to do that. It's not. Nowhere in the Federal Reserve Act does it say that they can do quantitative easing. They just did it. In fact, I think one reason they get away with it, they can use such a big word that nobody really knows what it is. You know, quantitative easing is like there's no image there. There's what are you easing? What are you quantitatively changing? So you say if it was called what it was supposed to be, now is being called quantitative easing for the people or helicopter money, where the money would actually get into the economy.
And in the case of Brazil, Rousseff, the administration there really saw huge increases of improvements of life for the people.
Until oil collapsed. And so the collapse of oil killed the economy of Brazil. It killed Russia. It killed Iran. I mean, these are clearly targets of that policy. Some people say it was market forces, but it clearly wasn't. I mean,
in part because the oil as a commodity is so heavily controlled by the global banks.
Right, and they do things that people don't realize that they're even allowed to do with people's deposits, which is things like buying ships and loading oil on them so that they can manipulate, they can hold that oil off the market or not. And, of course, they buy these oil derivatives with which they manipulate prices. So all the prices are manipulated these days, and it's the big banks controlling them. So then you have Brazil, Russia, India had a change of government. Now it's more right-wing. The Chinese are complaining that they're under attack, that their currency is under attack, that George Soros is attempting to do what was done to the British currency in 1992, where he short-sold the currency and brought it down. And then you have the obvious attacks in the Middle East where, you know, Libya, for example, was a strong, stellar example of what you could do with your own bank if you had control over it. And so that had to go. So they destroyed Libya, and Libya was going to spread that model throughout Africa. So that hasn't happened. South Africa is under attack. But in the U.S., we have our one stellar model, which is the Bank of North Dakota, which is still going strong despite the oil manipulation, assuming it actually was manipulated for political purposes. It may have been intended also to get North Dakota, possible, but it didn't. North Dakota managed to weather it well, largely because of their publicly owned bank.
The thing that struck me about all the things that you're talking about around the world, the struggle that people are making, and here in the U.S. now to create public banks, this is a time-honored process of to try to retain control of our money from these private interests, from the, we're essentially the global bankers. We find ourselves in a similar sort of a place all around the world in some of these other places, with Greece and Ireland and Iceland, and perhaps now in the EU.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Brexit is a very interesting thing that's coming up for a vote in a month. It's highly controversial. So, I mean, even among ourselves, we're not sure which way we would vote if we had a vote. But there are all sorts of signs of change, like radical change. Who would have thought that the EU might break up, like even 10 years ago? And the fact that we've got two opposite political leaders who are ready to lead basically populist revolutions, you know, they're not scripted, they're not under the control of the usual establishment interests, and their message has resonated with the people. People are ready for change. Some professor explaining that when people are unhappy as they are today, the candidate for change will always win over the candidate for maintaining the status quo.
Right.
So we could be looking at some big changes.
I definitely think we are, and for exactly that reason, that the system that we've been given to live with, which is monetary servitude and debt, is in control, and people are struggling to get free, and they're looking anywhere they can to do so, and public banks provide one of those alternative routes. But ultimately, I think we wind up looking to each other to move the ball in the direction of justice and fairness and progress for the people. Thanks very much, Ellen, for the input now, and we'll see what happens.
Okay, thank you. Great talking to you. My guest today is Dr. Roseanne Enerson-Junker, an expert in the very interesting topic of the Bank of North Dakota. Roseanne holds a doctorate in history, political science, and anthropology, and is the author of the Bank of North Dakota, an experiment in state ownership. She's also featured in an excellent documentary by Prairie Public Broadcasting called The Bank of North Dakota, and we are fortunate to have her as a lead speaker at our first Public Banking Institute conference in Philadelphia in 2012. It's great to be talking with you, Roseanne.
Thank you, Alan. I'm pleased to be here.
So the Bank of North Dakota has been generating a lot of interest lately. It's the nation's only state-owned depository bank, and according to the Wall Street Journal about a year and a half ago, it is more profitable than J.P. Morgan Chase or Goldman Sachs. So that disproves the notion that the government can't run a business profitably, as you often hear. And now that we've had an oil bust for the last couple of years, the notion has also been disproved that the Bank of North Dakota was successful only because of oil, because North Dakota itself, you know, had an oil boom. So that's no longer true. And yet, at the end of last year, December 2015, they came out with their 2015 annual report, which reported its most profitable year ever. In fact, they've had record profits every year for the last 12 years. Like, every year is better than the last one. So attempting to follow their lead, there are like 20 states and a number of cities and counties that have brought bills of one sort or another for a state-owned bank. And at the Public Banking Institute, we're always getting inquiries on it, how they did it, what sort of opposition they faced and all that. So you're an expert on all that, so that's why I'm really pleased to be able to talk to you. But before we get into that, I wondered if you wanted to just say a little bit about how you got into it and, you know, what your connection is to North Dakota and the bank and so forth.
Well, I got into it. It was my dissertation topic when I was doing my dissertation, and I grew up on a farm in North Dakota. And I also went to my local bank, the Bank of Hamilton, which is up in Pembina County, for student loans when I started as a freshman at Jamestown College in North Dakota. And the local bank, it was a small community bank, said, we don't give you a loan. You need to go to the Bank of North Dakota in Bismarck for your student loans, which I did. And they were fabulous. I paid them off. I just was looking at their 2015 report, and they have $1.8 billion in student loans. It's right up there with the commercial loans. It's phenomenal.
Wow, that's one of my many questions. We're actually, you know, of course, always trying to. We're always talking about a state bank here in California, and then people say, oh, well, we can't do student loans because they're too risky. The students are liable to default, and we can't do homeowner loans because they're too risky. They're liable to default, and small businesses, they're risky. So how is it that the Bank of North Dakota has managed to be profitable with all that? But maybe I'm jumping ahead of the gun. Maybe
should. Yeah, let's go back a little bit. I think
yeah, we'll go on the
because it is important when you look at California, we're really looking at 100 years ago. The bank was formed in 1919, and this is 2016. So comparing North Dakota and California is a little bit like apples and oranges. But let's go back and look at North Dakota in 1915, 1916.
If I could just say one thing, you know, yeah. People say that, you know, well, this is California, it's not North Dakota, so we can't do it. But one thing I know that you'll probably talk about is they had a serious uphill battle, and yet they did it. I mean, it's not like we couldn't do it. We actually have more resources and more possibilities here than they had there, and yet they pulled it off.
I think you're right. All I'm saying is that you probably can't use it as a blueprint for how to establish it. It can be a blueprint for what is established, but the process may be somewhat different. In other words, it will be difficult to do, and some of the struggle may be a different sort of struggle. But let's just look back there. North Dakota had been a state for 30 years when the bank was founded. It became a state in 1889, and it was really a one-crop economy, and that crop was wheat. You had 90% of the people in North Dakota were farming. And also, women didn't have the right to vote. So women weren't engaged in voting for the Bank of North Dakota. It was primarily the farmers who were voting for the bank. And the state had been run primarily by the Republican Party machine. This was the era of big machine politics. And a fellow named Alexander Mackenzie, who was originally from Toronto, was really running the Republican National Committee in North Dakota, and he determined who ran and what industries, etc. He left school when he was 11 years old. He became a scout for General Custer when he was 16, and he ended up running the Republican Party. Now, For 30 years after statehood, there were a number of organizations and political movements that really tried to get rid of the graft, if you will, the control of North Dakota's banking, grain storage, elevators, and railroads. The control of those three big industries was controlled by out-of-state interests, primarily interests out of Minneapolis and St. Paul. So you had the Farmers Alliance, you had the Independence Party, you had the Populists, the Progressives, the Farmers Union Cooperative Movement, the Grange, all trying to break the hold of the Republican Party on state politics. And they slowly, slowly, slowly eroded that hold. Now, farmers like to complain. And even in the good years, I mean, I know from whence I speak, I guess I should say this. Even in the good years, there's something to complain about. Even if they have a good crop, the weather was lousy. So there's a lot of things they can't control. There's the grain markets are national and international. The weather is bad. There's droughts. There was monopoly pricing in the early 1900s. And add to that, the banks were charging the farmers usurious interest rates. In fact, the U.S. Comptroller of the Currency said in 1912 that the rates that the banks were charging, which was a 12% rate, was easily 3% over what was legal. So, and two-thirds of the nationally chartered banks in North Dakota were charging 12% or higher. And I interviewed a state senator who was really a wonderful man who said, you know, I went up to the bank with my dad to get a $100 loan. The bank charged him $20 to make the loan, and then they charged him 12% interest. So he left the bank with $68, you know, on a $100 loan. Right. So, and he says it's things like that that brought the Bank of North Dakota into its being. So out of all these political movements, the one that was actually able to create the bank was the Nonpartisan League. And the Nonpartisan League was started by a fellow named A.C. Townley, Arthur Charles Townley, who had been a farmer in the northwest corner of North Dakota. He'd been a flax farmer, and he was wiped out by a spring snowstorm, late snowstorm, and decided that, well, he went to work for the Socialist Party, which was organizing and had any number of organizations throughout the state at that time. And he was a good salesman, and he understood that the farmers were too independent to really want to get behind a party. They wanted socialism, but they didn't want the doctrine of socialism. So he created what he called an organizational department, a very benign sounding department, an organizational department within the Socialist Party. And he started recruiting farmers for this organizational department because the farmers liked the idea of a state-owned bank that would loan them their own money, the state's own money, at a much lower interest rate. Well, the Socialist Party didn't like the idea of an organizational development, so they fired Townley. But he continued. He had a good idea. He continued on, and within 4 years, the Nonpartisan League had taken control of state government. They had governor, they had all of the state office holders, they had control of the legislature, both the Senate and the House, and they had control of the state Supreme Court. So they immediately, he drove around the state. I was looking at it. There's probably 100,000 voters at that time. So you can reach quite a number of people if you just have 100,000 voters that you need to reach and you have a good idea. And everybody was being overcharged, and most of the people were farmers. And so, I mean, the thing to remember is that he sold not only a state-owned bank, but he sold the idea of a state grain elevator, mill and elevator as well. So not only were they going to finance farming, you're going to be able to sell your grain to a state-owned elevator that was going to pay you a better rate than these out-of-state elevators would have paid you. So
very appealing.
So one great political organization, and it took probably, I think they started in June. I think by March they had all of the bills legislated, and there was opposition on the floor of the Senate and the House, but they were of course outvoted. So they immediately, I mean, one of the good things that they did is they hired a banker to run the bank. You know, they hired a fellow named Cathro, who became the director general of the bank, and he had been the first president of the North Dakota Bankers Association. So they immediately turned over the bank to a legitimate banker, not a politician.
You know, they actually did that in Australia with the Commonwealth Bank of Australia, which was a very successful national publicly owned bank. And when the legislature decided, it was in 1912, and the banks had failed, the private banks had failed, and the legislature decided that they needed a, you know, a state-owned bank, that the government needed to take it over. So they set up the bank, but again, they did the same thing where they appointed it was the bankers themselves who were nervous about the competition, so they made sure they got one of their own in there to head the bank. But the thing is, he knew how banking worked. He knew that banks just created the money. They just extended credit. And so when the bankers came to him and said, well, you're going to need to borrow from us, you know, you're going to need some loans, and he said, no, I think we're just going to extend the credit of Australia, which he did, and funded all sorts of industries across the country and funded World War I without borrowing from the big banks and the Bank of England, which that was his downfall, because he went to England and we went to, you know, the City of London and bragged about that they managed, that they didn't need help. And he had a heart attack at a rather young age soon afterwards.
You know, financing the bank really was critical. You know, where are they going to, how are they going to, you had the state deposits, but the state deposits weren't nearly enough to meet the needs of the borrowers.
Yeah,
you
know, that would be a more challenging proposition than Australia, because that was a country that could issue, I mean, the central bank did issue the national currency. So, yeah, a state bank has to deal with the national currency. They don't have the power to issue it. So, yeah, go ahead.
But what they could issue is they could issue state bonds. And so that was their goal. They immediately tried to issue both real estate bonds and, well, the real estate bonds were the most important ones, because the real estate bonds would allow them to fund the farmers' need for equipment, land, buying land, and buying seed. So that was their goal. And so they did a couple of things right away. They agreed not to make loans to individuals. And that's one of the things the state banks asked them. The state bank says, well, we'll work with you, but you can't make loans to private individuals. So the Bank of North Dakota said, okay, but we will make loans to farmers on farmland, but we loan on allowing you to buy a car or a refrigerator or something like that. And they also said, we will redeposit our money back into the local banks. So they became kind of a pass-through bank, if you will. And it was a way to gain the support of the state banks initially, the other state banks initially. So even though the deposits were first, the deposits, the taxation, say, from the municipalities, the taxes went into the Bank of North Dakota, Bank of North Dakota turned around and redeposited them in the local banks, so the local banks could make the loans based on that money, and the Bank of North Dakota would buy those loans back. So it was a bit convoluted. That actually, the state banks turned around and stabbed them in the back. And I can get to that in a minute, but the sale of the bonds is what needed to happen. And of course, that meant that the Bank of North Dakota had to go to Wall Street to sell these bonds, or to large investment houses to sell these bonds. And so the Minneapolis interests, the railroads, the grain elevators, and the national banks were not going to take the idea of the Bank of North Dakota lying down. And they created a massive opposition effort, both to discredit the bank, to discredit the bank itself, to discredit the personnel at the bank, and to discredit the people in politics. And they did a number of things. They really wanted to cripple the entire program. So they created a new party called the Independent Voters Association to run against the Nonpartisan League. And the Independent Voters Association, which was run out of Minnesota, put on the ballot a referendum of the industrial plan. After the plan had passed, they said, you know, we're going to refer this plan to the voters. We don't think the voters really meant you to do this, even though they elected you on a platform to do this. We don't believe they did. Okay, so the referendum went through, let's see, the bank was passed in 1919. The referendum went through in 1919 in the fall, and the voters said, no, we really did want the industrial measures to go through. We meant what we said, and we said what we meant. Little Dr. Seuss here. So there was also infighting between the members of the NPL, and you had Bill Langer, who became a very famous North Dakota politician and a senator, who quit the Nonpartisan League He was a very ambitious man, and Townley was a very ambitious man, and there was a lot of ego involved and personal politics involved. And so there were three members of the Nonpartisan League who were elected government officials who quit the NPL, you know, and that sort of power struggle, that crippled the NPL a little bit. So people began to wonder, what's going on here? And then the Independent Voters Association also took to the North Dakota District Court, the State Supreme Court, and the U.S. Supreme Court a challenge, saying that the state didn't have the right to create a state-owned bank. Now, they lost in 1920. The U.S. Supreme Court said, well, you know, if the citizens of the state want to do this, then the state can do it. But what was happening was that the opponents were creating all this chaos in the minds of the public and certainly in the minds of investors as to whether buying North Dakota state bonds would be too risky of an investment to make.
Right.
And so every time there was a sale, a possible sale to go through, there's some chaos that they created in the marketplace and the people would pull back from buying. Now, they eventually went to the labor unions, the national magazines, church groups in Chicago, Michigan, Montana, the locomotive engineers. The North Dakota bond was the farmers union label, the garment workers, the railroad clerks. You had the Clarence Darrow, the lawyer, the ACLU lawyer. You had Alice Stone Blackwell, the suffragette. All of these people, I mean, people today we would say are progressives, people on the left were buying, are trying to buy the state bonds to get the bank operationalized. Well, finally, in October of 1921, there was a recall election of all of the Nonpartisan League. So within 2 years of the bank being established, they had been able to make a few loans. They hadn't been able to make very many loans. You had two planting seasons go by. Farmers were dissatisfied because the loans weren't being made. They didn't know what was going on. And the population voted to recall the Nonpartisan League, and they put in all the Independent Voters Association members. At almost the same time, an investment house in Chicago, Spitzer Rorick bought $6 million of the bonds, and eventually, within a few more months, another $6 million. So they had sold $12 million of the real estate bonds at the very time that the people of the state of North Dakota voted out the Nonpartisan League and put the people who opposed the bank in control of the bank. So it was, yes, we want the bank to continue, but we really want somebody else to run it. And the Independent Voters Association, the new governor, had the opportunity to replace the governing body of the bank, which was elected officials, the governor, the secretary of state, and the commissioner of agriculture, or the industrial commission that serve as the governing board of the Bank of North Dakota. He had the opportunity then to turn that governing board over to a non-political board. And as governor, he said, no, I don't think so. I think we'll just keep it in the hands of the Independent Voters Association. So, I mean, he knew a good thing when he saw it, because it's, I know you mentioned as we began the conversation that for the last 12 years, there's been record profits. I think that the bank has probably shown a profit. What is it? It's almost 100 years old. It's shown a profit 90 of those 100 years, if not 95. You know, it has not always made a huge profit. It probably lost money the first couple of years, although through accounting manipulations, they were able to show that they hadn't lost money. It was just on collectible debt. But really, it's never been a drain on North Dakota throughout its entire history.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that actually makes sense when you understand how banking works. You have a choice. Now we know, according to the Bank of England, that banks create virtually the entire money supply, not governments. So you have a choice of borrowing from a private bank and paying them interest, or borrowing from yourself, because states have a lot of money. You know, they have their if they use their own deposits, instead of putting their deposits into Wall Street and letting Wall Street lend them back to them, use them for the basis of their loans, they can borrow their own deposits. So they can do what Wall Street does, which is basically duplicate. You know, the deposits are still there for purposes of withdrawal. And if they're not, you can borrow from other banks or the Federal Reserve or, you know, the backstops. And meanwhile, you can make loans with that same money. loans of money created on the books as accounting entries.
But the difference is when you have a state-owned bank, you have the concept of service to the people. And I know that service is built into, you know, national banks. I'll talk about their service to the community. But really, their primary motivation is return on their investment. I mean, their return to their shareholders is their number one priority. With a state-owned bank, service to the people of the state can be your number one priority. And so it allows, and it has allowed, the state of North Dakota to do any number of interesting policy, you know, implement different policies and fund those policies at a much lower cost than they would have been able to do if the municipalities had to sell on the open market. You know, I mean, during the 30s and the 40s, you had a huge depression, and almost half of the people in North Dakota were on some kind of government assistance. I think the average annual income was $145 a year for a North Dakota household. It was 40% below the national average. But schools were issuing warrants to their teachers because they didn't have the money to pay the teachers. Teachers, if they were to take those warrants to the bank took a discount on them, but the teachers could mail those warrants into the Bank of North Dakota, and the Bank of North Dakota paid them the full price for those discounts. A number of the state institutions needed money to continue, like the state school at Grafton, the tuberculosis sanitarium, even some of the colleges needed money to keep themselves running, and they were able to borrow from the state bank. The highway departments needed money. There was just, you know, the bank was able to support many state institutions and departments.
So it's sort of like what the Federal Reserve has done for Wall Street, where they have supported them with all this credit when they were in trouble. So the state is supporting the local.
Yeah, the state really,
businesses, which then pay taxes, so it's all good for the state instead of being a drain on the economy where all the profits are going out to this private banking conglomerate.
No, that's absolutely true. That's absolutely, it does operate like a mini Fed at times for state bankers. The other thing that it did during the 40s, you know, after the war, there was a lot of money put into a lot of growth, city sewers, water, rural electrification, and of course it was able to finance all of those bonds as well. And I was just looking, they've got three new programs on their books this year, and of course part of it has to do with the big oil boom in the western part of the state and not having the kind of infrastructure in place to manage that very well. And it will be interesting to see in the next couple of years how that price of oil shakes out. But I've got no doubt that they've got terrific management. And one of the things I really liked about, I think it's Eric Hardemeyer, who's the president of the bank, and he's been the president for the last 10 years or so. He said, you know, when all that stuff came around and he was talking about the derivatives and that sort of thing that caused the meltdown in 2008, he says, if we couldn't understand it, we didn't invest in it. You know, and it's such wonderful common sense.
So sensible,
right?
Yeah. So do you have anything you want to wrap up with?
Well, I wish you and the public banking movement all the success, because it's obviously worked in North Dakota. There's obviously different situations in different places, but the idea is sound. So I just say good luck and go for it, and I hope it works.
Thank you. Do you have anywhere where you can direct people to your work?
There's a Prairie Public video on the Bank of North Dakota. There's the video that Michael Moore put up on capitalism, you know, his video Capitalism. He put up maybe a 20-minute video on his interview with me for that movie.
Well, it's been great speaking with you.
Well, thank you, Ellen, and all the best.
Same to you. I've been speaking with Roseanne Anderson-Junker, author of The Bank of North Dakota, An Experiment in State Ownership.
Now we head to Chicago, where the intrigue of insider corporate public finance has spawned a new citizen movement called the TIF Illumination Project, as well as a collaborative book that's aiming to educate citizens about how to get a grip on the public dollars that are slipping away through rather secretive but commonplace methods used by municipalities around the country ostensibly to stimulate local economies by giving tax breaks to special interests. Tax increment financing, or TIFs, as they're called. Our guest, Tom Tresser, is a longtime public banking supporter and leader, considers himself a civic educator and a public defender against the machinations of crony politics. The new book is called Chicago is Not Broke, Funding the City We Deserve.
The TIF Illumination Project caught fire because of a couple of things lining up here in Chicago a few years ago. So Mayor Emanuel was elected. He's perceived as a privatizer, you know, sort of the new face of the Chicago machine, you know, Chicago Machine 3.0. And then he's closed 50 schools. So nobody's ever done that. Not even Daley, in the height of his power, did something like that. And, you know, the city was reeling. Many of us thought that was just even too much for him, and that anybody with a kid in school, it was just chaos. But as a result of that trauma going through the city, when we just started the launch of the TIF Illumination Project, it was in the middle of all that.
Describe for us what TIF is.
TIFs, tax increment financing, is something that is prevalent all over the country. It's another one of these snarky deals where a mayor essentially creates a special district ostensibly to build something that couldn't be built otherwise in a so-called blighted area. And what happens is when a TIF district is created, we note how much property tax the properties inside the TIF district are spinning off at that moment, which is called the base. And you need to remind ourselves about how many organizations in the country rely on property taxes to operate. In many states, property tax fuels public education. And in the state of Illinois, it's excessively so because we have a progressive income tax, one of the worst in America, which means there's an extra burden on property tax across the state to fund public education. So if you live in a wealthy community, property taxes are high and there's a mall or a factory or other things spinning off lots of property taxes, then your schools will be flush and will want for little. But you go a few miles away and you're in a poor part of the county and the opposite happens. Your schools look like crap. So then your education, access to great education, is a lottery based on where you were born. So that's not right. People have been writing about public education and equity and connections between a robust public education system and our democracy and middle class. All those things are tightly intertwined. Note with despair that this difference happens in places that rely unfairly on property taxes, which is the case in Chicago and Illinois. And that's why we need to note any entity that takes a dollar of property tax off the table. That's what TIFs do. So in the TIF district, once it's created, the TIF now extracts all property tax value above that base for 23 years.
Wow.
So
23
so,
years?
Yes, it's a generation. And it started in California and it moved all over the country. It's in 47 states right now. There is no single accounting, actually. This is something we're actually trying to address here with the newspaper magazine In These Times. And we're going to be launching a national research project to try to just count how many TIF districts there are in the country and just how much are we talking about. My estimation is that there could be as many as 6,000 of these TIF districts, which are all controlled by local mayors, that are pulling away maybe as much as $20 billion in property taxes every year. So what happens to these taxes once they're extracted? You know, they're off the top. They go into essentially a black box controlled by your local mayors to be dispensed in a giant slush fund for projects that are favored by the mayor. And in Chicago, $7 billion in property taxes have gone missing since TIFs came here in 1986. We're not sure where a lot of that money went, but our best guess is approximately $5 billion of that $7 billion went to developers.
And why is it not transparent? Why can't you track it, Tom?
Because you don't want us to. This is the goose that lays the golden egg. This is the secret sauce behind the Chicago machine, where, you know, Mayor Daley took power in 1989, and he ruled for almost 27 years, I think. And TIFs under his administration skyrocketed from, you know, relatively handful to, I think there's 164 TIF districts. And then when Mayor Emanuel came in, he closed some and started a few more. So right now there's about 148 active TIF districts. But they throw off $500 million in property taxes every year. That's a pile of money that no mayor wants to do without. And like I say, in just about every state, virtually every cities everywhere are struggling with this. So the mayors want them, and taxpayers and other kinds of researchers or other kinds of advocates are pushing back against them. School districts are suing their own mayors.
Yeah.
Because the schools are the biggest single loser when a TIF is created.
I noticed one of your figures in Chicago's Not Broke, Funding the City We Deserve, which is the name of the book, that you point out that about $500 million was cut from the school budget, and then that the mayor wants to still raise $1 billion to fund expansion of a civic center. Is that right?
Yeah. So the book, Chicago's Not Broke, Funding the City We Deserve, is based on the TIF work. Because if you're showering hundreds of millions of dollars on private businesses without much due process, then we really can't be broke. But then, as I say, Chicago has closed public schools, mental health centers, curtailed public transit. So everyone's feeling the squeeze all over the city. At the same time, property taxes are going up. Regressive methods of getting money, like red light cameras that zap you with a $100 fine, and speed cameras, and fees, and fees, and more fees. All these things are being heaped on the people. And so we're trying to push back against that entire narrative of scarcity. And this is what we have in common, you know, as civic educators, is we're trying to tell the public that do not accept the frame of America is broke, Illinois is broke, or Chicago is broke until we have thoroughly investigated these other aspects of public finance. So
Right. What
we're doing is we're looking at three pockets of money. The first pocket of money is called money that's been stolen from us, money that we should not have had to spend nor should continue to spend. And that's corruption, bad toxic bank deals, which is what you guys are researching on a national level. But we have some really doozies of crappy deals here in Chicago. Toxic swaps with the Board of Education is probably at the top of that list. And then also the cost of police violence. Unfortunately, across America, you know, a spotlight has been thrown on shootings of unarmed black men by various police forces. And in Chicago, we have a horrible, horrible record of abuse of civilians by the police force over decades, including torture and unarmed shootings. And just in the last 10 years, the police department and the city of Chicago have settled lawsuits and litigation to the tune of $600 million.
Wow.
So these abuses continue, and they don't get checked. They don't get reined in. They just get passed along, and the police department doesn't reform itself.
Mm-hmm.
Cover-ups continue. Mm-hmm. And so we have a Polk Award-winning journalist, Jamie Calvin, who broke the story on the shooting of Laquan McDonald back in October of last year. It was his article in Slate called 16 Shots that ripped the cover off this entire brutal piece of Chicago's history. So that's a very sad part of this book. So we've wasted that money. The lives are lost. The lives are beyond repair. What we're saying is stop that practice. But if we don't stop the practice, we're going to lose another $5 to $10 million a year, not to mention whatever lives are ruined.
Yeah, and you've estimated that that bucket one, or that parcel of money that you didn't need to spend, amounts to $1 billion.
About,
new,
yes.
Or
yeah,
released
right.
Revenue every year.
That's right.
Every
so
year.
That's right, because we're talking about cost of corruption itself. A team of academics and researchers have been working on this for decades. They say it's about $500 million a year. So if we don't correct the endemic corruption, that's $500 million we're wasting right there. The cost of the toxic bank deals are estimated to have been about $1 billion up to now, but it will be another billion going forward if we don't correct or back out of those deals. And then the cost of police violence is another $5 to $10 million a year. So that's bucket one. Bucket two is the TIFs. So we've already talked about TIFs. The way I'm characterizing it for the sake of this book is, well, we are collecting this money. This property tax is being collected as part of our regular annual tax cycle, but it's hidden from us. You know what I'm saying? It's like it's off the books.
Money, you say, is hidden. It's taken off the tax, but isn't it authorized on some level by the city council?
Yes. Every TIF district is passed by law. You know, there's a statute that creates every TIF district, but it's a completely opaque process to the taxpayer. It's not part of the annual budgeting process, which is already sketchy and full of rubber stamp accords to the mayor's wishes. But the property taxes that are on the books, which is about $850 million and change, that will show up and is part of the annual budget cycle that does get some debate, at least in city council. Mm-hmm. So what we're saying is the budget is a moral document, aside from a political document. And this is how we know where our world is going, where our city is going, where our priorities are, what's being attended to and what's not being attended to, regardless of the lip service that's being paid to various topics. We always say follow the money. You do the best you can as the budget is being publicized, and it's always a hurry up, again, rubber stamp process in the city of Chicago. But there is some opportunity, limited though it may be, for the public to have input on our budget. It happens very fast. But what we're talking about with TIFs is completely not that. It is not part of the budgeting process. It's a completely clout-driven, rifle shot, project by project. You read about it in the funny papers process. And as I say, it's about $500 million in property taxes taken off the table every year. The other part of this TIF conundrum is the amount of money that's in the TIF accounts, the sort of running balance, if you will. So in addition to how much money we're collecting, we also have a bunch in the bank. So money comes in, money is spent out of TIF districts, but we are still left at the end of the year with about a $1.5 billion balance. So that's a separate issue that has now become quite controversial here in the city of Chicago. You've got the unions, you've got tenants groups, good government groups sort of asking for an accounting of where the $1.4 billion is just sitting in the TIF accounts.
Yeah.
What is the disposition of that money? And so that's kind of part of this entire, we just simply don't believe you, Mayor Mayo. So that's part of the second bucket. And the third bucket is where we really cross paths, because that's what we call that bucket, the money that we're not collecting. And that's three chapters there. The first is, what would happen if we had a progressive income tax? The state of Illinois, Chicago's share would be very considerable. Second is a financial transaction tax on our Wall Street, you know, LaSalle Street, which is probably the single biggest component of the entire book. And then finally, last but not least, is what would happen if we had a public bank for the city of Chicago? And that's written by Amara Enya,
true,
who ran for mayor last year.
Yep. One of our colleagues.
Yes.
Yep.
And she breaks it out and explains it and, you know, introduces the concept for people who presume probably most people have not heard of this idea of a public bank. And, you know, she finally says, okay, so what would it look like here? Well, you know, what would we do with such a thing here in Chicago? How would it help us? She chose to focus on the amount that we could save here if we self-financed our bonds,
right,
and other kinds of infrastructure. And it's billions of dollars that we would save.
Yes, billions of dollars, yeah.
And so that's pretty, you know, you put it all together, and it's a big number.
Well, you know, it's really necessary because of the obfuscation that's done around municipal finance, the control, the acquisition, you know, and how it's deployed, the fees that are paid to people who are financial managers in the Wall Streets, and, of course, these rotten swap deals that has consumed hundreds of billions of dollars really around the country, it's stunning. And that's what Wall Street Costs America Project is doing.
Mm-hmm.
It truly is a national issue that is so below the surface, below the radar of people's awareness, that when they complain about taxes, they have no idea where this money is really going to, nor do they have a sense of what it would look like if they were to do, as you said, taking back control of it. Yeah, so your work's very exciting and great example of what citizens can do in their own municipalities. And, you know, we certainly look forward to partnering with you in helping to articulate some of these opportunities.
We will have teaching guides. People can do study groups. They can use this material in their churches, in their block clubs, in their elementary schools or high schools. We'll make a comic book version of this thing. And the idea is to flood the specific market with this information for the next 6 months in order to influence the debate over the 2017 Chicago budget.
Yeah.
So we want people to be waving these little books, you know, at their aldermen.
Great. It's interesting that in this day where we have the internet and the ability and social media and the ability to really talk to each other, parties are being sidestepped by the people. And of course we see that in some ridiculous examples on the national stage and some encouraging ones where the mainstream parties are not able to necessarily keep their people in control.
Well, it's funny you mention that, because this is actually part of a 3-year arc that leads to Chicago's 2019 municipal elections. You know, we're trying to think ahead, and, you know, you make the citizens armed and dangerous, and then you start doing a candidate training school in 2018 to encourage people from our world, the people that we know, who we met all across the city, and other organizers and progressive forces, to try to get people to run for office, you know, as candidates for aldermen in 2019, using this book as part of their platform. In my fantasy world, candidates who are seeking to run for alderman and even mayor in 2019 would have to speak to these issues,
yes,
or they'll be defeated.
And we actually are seeing candidacies around the country who are people who are building their platforms around public banking.
Exactly. The more they talk about it, the more sense it makes. Now that makes them a leader in their community. It makes them an innovator. They're bringing something new, a solution to the table. And then now they take on that role of being a civic educator. Because to be a good leader, especially when you're edging out, like we are here with this idea of a public bank, you have to educate. And so you're educating, you're making people angry, You're revealing the conflicts and contradictions of the current system. You're calling out people who for liars, profit takers. But at the end of the day, the best leaders will have a solution. And they say, you know what? We have a solution for you. And don't take my word for it. Just look at the great state of North Dakota.
Right.
A conservative, prairie, Republican state. If they can do it, why can't we? And then your citizens are left with like a good question. Like, you know, that's a darn good question. Why can't we? You know, that's where the revolution happens, right in there. When you have a lot of people scratching their heads going, that looks like a darn good idea to me.
So, Tom, congratulations on this book coming out. And tell us how we can participate and support this book through your crowdfunding exercise.
Yeah, appreciate that. Well, all you have to do is go to wearenotbroke.org, wearenotbroke.org, and you'll see the book outlined there, all the authors and their bios. We're starting to paste a little teaser copy up there. But that's also the link to our crowdfunding platform, our Generosity. And we're seeking to raise $10,000. That will allow us to not only pay our talent, but print 5,000 copies. And our goal is to, as I say, flood the civic market and just sort of make this the talk of the town.
That's great, Tom. Thanks very much for being on the program today.
You're welcome.
That's Tom Presser. The book is Chicago Is Not Broke, Funding the City We Deserve, .org. So continuing on the theme of Wall Street extraction of public dollars, here's Matt Stannard.
A special edition today of What Wall Street Costs America, the Public Banking Institute's new project to document the economic and human costs of the hundreds of billions of dollars spent by states and municipalities on interest and fees and the losses in risky investment schemes of Wall Street entities. I want to talk today about a big city and a small town, and how both of them suffered greatly because of the financing of public services, public pensions, and social needs being privatized rather than being a public utility. Let's begin with a small town, Harrison, New Jersey, population varying between 13 and 14,000. The town has seen good times and bad times, and like many municipalities, struggled with the mortgage and banking crisis of the late 2000s. So developers proposed building a professional soccer stadium, eventually to be called Red Bull Arena after the sponsoring energy drink. Construction opened in 2010, and the town imagined it would spur widespread economic revitalization. The stadium took years longer to build than the city had been promised, and did not spur the promised development of surrounding condominiums or other income-intensive businesses. Harrison had been banking on redevelopment revenue to cover the $39 million in debt it had incurred to buy and clean up the land under the Major League Soccer Stadium. Instead, the city had to pile on more debt to pay the original debt, 21% of its municipal tax collections, and it later ended up firing scores of police and firefighters to cover the debt. This led one writer to say that the arena turned Harrison into one of the poorest, most lawless places in America. Next, we examine a much bigger entity, the city of Detroit, the largest city in Michigan and the fourth largest city in the Midwest. Decades of engineered deindustrialization by economists from both major political parties deeply damaged Detroit and other Midwestern cities. Detroit went from 2 million residents in 1950 to a little over 700,000 in 2010, as its revenue steadily declined. Property values declined as well, and despite the social contract once assumed to exist between the ruling class and the working class, nobody wanted to help the city out. In 2005, Detroit entered into a series of complex financial deals with Wall Street firms to assume $1.6 billion in debt. These included interest rate swaps that carried hidden risks, When the Federal Reserve later drove interest rates down to near zero, the banks brokering the deals exercised the option to terminate the swaps and make the interest and fees payable immediately, and those fees included the entire future value of the swaps. Detroit ended up owing hundreds of millions of dollars to the banks. As Wallace Turbeville wrote in 2013, the banks and insurance companies were in a far better position to understand the magnitude of these risks, and they had at least an ethical duty to forbear from providing the swaps under such precarious circumstances. Detroit sunk into undemocratic emergency management and bankruptcy proceedings, none of which had been inevitable. A Michigan State bank, a public bank, could have put Detroit in a better position to finance its public needs at any step of the way. During the 1970s, when deindustrialization began in earnest, and anywhere along the line all through the 2000s and 2010s, the people of Detroit did not cause the crises that put their city into bankruptcy court. Likewise, the people of Harrison, New Jersey, did not cause the national economic downturn that prevented them from gaining the development profits that should have followed their construction of the stadium. But they paid for it. If New Jersey had had a public bank, they could have built the stadium at extremely low interest and restructured their payment schedules according to their needs and used the public bank to finance the housing developments they hoped would follow the construction of the stadium. And there are more stories, hundreds of them, in cities and counties and states all over America, where governments have fallen victim to the myth that the only way they can finance their operations, pensions, and public services is by borrowing money at outrageous interest rates and fees, and allowing Wall Street to invest public money in absurdly risky and complex gambling schemes. It's because these stories need to be told, as a prerequisite to understanding their potential solutions, that the Public Banking Institute has started What Wall Street Costs America, which you can learn more about by visiting whatwallstreetcosts.org. What Wall Street Costs America will provide the only aggregated look at our local and national debt costs using data gathered by the Public Banking Institute and many partner organizations, think tanks, educational institutions, scholars, journalists, and you, the people who live in the cities and counties and states, and who are in a unique position to access both data and compelling narratives, like the interview we had here on the show a few weeks ago with Barnett Wright, the Alabama journalist who described how Wall Street ruined Jefferson County. If you visit whatwallstreetcosts.org, you'll learn what you can do to get involved, from becoming a research partner and sending us the numbers, to becoming a co-narrator and sending us stories, recordings, and videos of what Wall Street did to the place you call home, to donating to the project so that we can build a compelling interactive platform for all of these pieces of the puzzle. Visit the site now, whatwallstreetcosts.org, and help us reclaim public money for the public good. I'm Matt Stannard for It's Our Money.
Well, that's it for this week's edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests and to our sponsor, Payment Management, a merchant payment processing company dedicated to economic fairness and justice. Payment Management invites you to receive a free analysis of your card processing needs and costs. More information is available at paymentmgmt.com. Be sure to stay in touch with the ongoing conversations around what's going on in our world of money by reading Ellen's blog at ellenbrown.com. And to learn more about public banking and how you can participate, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. Thanks for listening. For Ellen Brown, I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.